Bay County Public Library, Panama City, Florida. The following speaker will be one of our Folk Life participants, Mr. W.R. Buddy Maddox, and he will be giving a talk on cast nets, turpentining, and blacksmithing at Wainwright Shipyard.
Well, I was born in 1912 in Jackson County, Florida, up here close to Mariana, and stayed in the Army Country until I was about 8 years old, and my father decided to leave Army Country and get out of it. So we started moving down. He said back then, when I was a small child, said, we may go down to Port Joe. He called Port St. Joe Port Joe. Well, we started to move in different places, and we didn't go to St. Joe to start with. We moved over here on Cook Bayou. That's where my turpentining experience started. But then we moved around in different places, and then I got big enough to go to work, and I started working turpentine and working with him, and we lived around. I've never lived 100 miles from where I was born in my whole 72 years. And I've lived right in this area around in Gulf County. Of course, it was all Calhoun, and I believe this was Washington County. And Gulf County was part of Calhoun before it was split off back in the early days of my life. But back in about 22 or 23, we moved over on Cook Bayou over here. It used to be called Camp Cook and Laird Mill Bayou. A lot of you are maybe familiar with that bayou, but there was a turpentine still not too far from us, and we worked for that man in the turpentine still. I don't remember his name right now, but I believe it was Gaynor. I'm not sure. But anyway, we worked for him in turpentine. Well, my dad was dipping and chipping, and I couldn't stay at home. I got me a bucket, what we call a water bucket, 8-quart bucket. And that's as big as I could tote. I was a little fella, 8 years old. And I'd go around with him, and I'd dip that foot and go pour it in the barrel. And I loved it so well, I'm going to almost cry when Sunday come, because we wouldn't work on Sunday. Well, that broke up, and we moved out of there, and we moved on to what we call White City. You know where that is? That road, there was not any paved roads in this country at all. All of these roads, 98 was not even here. And the road from Panama City to Port St. Joe was Worcestershire. They put the shells in to keep it from being boggy. Well, the road from Port St. Joe to Weaver Hitchcock was clay, a clay road. Well, we moved out from here, and we went on up to White City. We worked turpentine a while there in 24. And in 24, the fall of 24 and the spring of 25, we lived in Port St. Joe. That's where I met my wife, was in 24. There was one house between the one she lived in and the one that we lived in. And we went to school together for a few months, about 4 months. I learned more in school. I learned more in those 4 months going to school to Miss Callie Carroll. I never will forget her. I learned more under her in 4 months than I ever learned in all of my schooling. But in 25, Daddy decided to leave Port St. Joe. He got out for a few months out of turpentining and went into commercial fishing. And we left there and we moved down here in Tenderfield. There's a place that we moved between Auburn and Farmdale. There's a little place called Bella. Mr. John Parrish had a turpentine still. Well, I was about 13 years old. And we started, and Daddy wanted to do something a little different. So we rented a crop of boxes, 6,000 faces. He wanted me to dip the gun while he put it in the cups. He did the chipping. And I dipped the gun, and I would get off of the truck, and I would stay all day in those swamps by myself, me just a 13-year-old boy. And one incident I want to tell that happened, that's the most exciting thing ever happened to me in that career. As a young child out there in those swamps, in those woods, a lot of trees would be places you'd go in a trail and have to come back out. That trail, the timber would not go all the way through the swamp. That's between here and Port St. Joe. But one day I was in there dipping by myself, and I went down in there, and I heard something coming, walking in the water. Water was about half leg deep, and I knew what a hog would sound like, but it was walking clear, fluid. And I said, Daddy, is that you? It was just about falling under that door right there, about 20 foot, 30 foot. And it stopped, whatever it did, stopped plumb still. Never made a sound, never made a move. I said, I called the wood rider's name. Don't remember now. I said, is that you? It stood, the thing stood right there, just plumb dead to still. And I said, Daddy, is that you? That animal, I know what it was now, but I didn't then. But it started walking again. It went right on through that swamp. It was after you got away from the edge of, say, 200-300-400 yards, there was no timber. It was just a low swamp, about high, a little bit higher than the ceiling, of tie-tie bushes, just as thick as they could grow, and water in the bottom. And he went on through that way. I went out to my barrel. I was scared then. I didn't know what to do. I went out to the barrel, and I got out to my barrel, and a snake caught a frog, a rain frog, and he started to holler. And I not have been able to stay there. I didn't know where to go or what to do, but it was so close to me till I got the probe in to find out what it was. I found out what that was. All right. Now then, let's break out a story here and tell you how that we started Turpentine before I get too far.
That was walking through the...
That was a panther.
Oh.
One of those yeller panthers is what it was. A lot of them through those woods back in the early 20s, see. And I say this now. I don't know how anybody else feels. The Lord just caused that thing to change his mind and not attack me, because there were not many people. They were not familiar with people. And you know, though, it was the same thing as a mountain lion back in the mountain as a panther in Florida. They're almost the same type of animal. And he stood there. I didn't have any protection at all, whatever. But I say to myself, the Lord protected me as a child and had him to change his mind and go through that swamp in the place of attacking me. He knew I was something different. And he stopped, and he anticipated what to do before he went on.
How much did you earn? Do you remember?
Yes, ma'am. I remember what our earning was. We got $5 a barrel. For a 55-gallon barrel of turpentine in the barrel. See, that's what we rented it, by the barrel. Uh-huh. Otherwise, you did it by the... Daddy would be getting so much by the tree, and I'd be getting so much for the barrel, but he rented it for $5 a barrel, and our average was a barrel and a half a day. $7.50 a day, and every 3 weeks. Every 3 weeks. See, it takes 3 weeks to put three streaks, which you put on once a week, to fill a quart cup full of turpentine under that face. And I was so slow in my dipping until the time I would get over to the end, Daddy would have it full again.
What was the dipping?
Taking it out of the cups and putting it in a bucket. We had a bucket that take 12 of them to fill this 55-gallon barrel. It was made out of a nail keg with a handle that had a pivot on it. Mm-hmm. And you tote it upside of your leg, see? You won't tote it upside of your leg. And you get to the barrel, you take it and dump it in the barrel. 12 of them made a barrel, see? And we worked that at that time. That was before the Depression Act. That was in the good time, before Hoover's time. That was back way on when money was a lot of money then. We were making $7.50 a day then. We were getting along good. And there was no way to cross this bay at all, only on a ferry boat. And one other thing happened one time. We lived right close to the man that run the ferry, old man Melvin Lewis. A lot of people remember Duffy and Hilton Lewis at Port St. Joe, run the automobile place. It's got the garage right under the overpass at the paper mill. Well, we lived right next to their store. They had a little ferry boat. Well, when Mr. Parrish would come over to Panama to get the payroll, he'd get on that ferry boat and they'd run across. And one morning, it was real foggy and they got lost in the bay. They didn't know where they was at. We got along the beach. We were right close to the store, right there. Just a little place like the government building from where we lived to where the Lewis's lived. We got here in a car in the bay, blowing a horn in the bay. And somebody hollered and they answered it. They said, we're lost out here in the fog. Said, go to Van Strange Point. There's an old settler lived down on the point about a quarter of a mile from the store, and blow your horn. Say they could get a course from that to where they landed was. That's the way they got them across there. All right, now then, in this turpentine, it taken six people operation to put one drop of turpentine in the first cup. See? We used they'd take a big husky black man with a broad axe and sharpen on one side, just like a Hugh Cross ties with, And it was about 12, the blade was about 12 inches long. And he'd go up to the tree, and the way they gauged the tree that was able to take care of a cup, they had he had a gauge in his hand, or they carried one, and if it was 8 inches through at waist high, chest high, it would take care of a cup. If it was bigger, it would take care of maybe two. And I have saw a pine large enough to have six faces on one tree. Well, you couldn't think about it. It was huge that way.
All
you couldn't
the way
think
around.
About it. Yeah, they're on each side. And he'd come up to that tree, and he would decide the most smoothest, best place to put a cup. Well, he'd hew down right at the ground, right at the root, about two licks, and get the bark and all of it off, and he'd turn that axe right over just like that. We had another man with a maul, maybe out of an eight or 12 inch tree, about 12 inches long, with a handle in the end of it. Right through the middle of it. When he turned that axe over like that and took it under that tree, this man would come with that maul and he'd pound it about two times. Well, he'd move it out and go to the next tree or the other side. Man would come up with a bunch of tins in his apron. He'd take one of those tins and stick it in that gash and tap it with his hammer and put a freaking nail on each side. He'd go on. A man would come with an armful of cups. He'd throw a cup down at it and he'd go on. Well, another man would come up with a nail apron full of 20 penny nails. Well, that tin was setting like that. Well, he'd gauge it, the length of that. He'd put the nail of that head to that tin and he would turn it over and drive it in that tree. Take that cup and it'd pop right under that nail head and sit right there. Well, the next man had a tool, a hack, we called it, with a crooked tool sharp in it, fastened in that handle, and then it had a 6-pound weight on the end of it, which was 12, 18 inches long, and virgin to use a shorter one. And he would come up, and he would get right over that tin, and he would make a streak on each side and come to the peak in the middle. Well, then the turkey time would start going in the cup. That was the operation to get your tree going. Well, they chip it every week. They'd come in there and chip it. It'd get higher and higher. When you got up here to buck boxes, they'd have to raise those cups. That's where we use this type hook to put under the tin. They use this type. They didn't use the flat cup so much up there. And another big husky man with a broad axe would come up to that tree after the face was up here. And he'd hit it with a sling and then another sling. And they'd put two tins. One of them would be coming this way and the other one would be going that way. They'd put a nail here and hang this cup, and the turpentine would come down the face and go in the tin and go in the cup. See? And then these cups got to bursting so bad in the winter when they freeze with water in them till they've got a V-type metal cup that would hang just like this. And you didn't raise the cup anymore. About once is all you raise it. Sometimes twice. Sometimes you raise it down here. And then the stages that they call those boxes, the first one was virgins. The next one was yearling. The next one was buck boxes. Then you had, buck boxes. Then you had snatch boxes. After it got so high you couldn't reach with that heavy weight, they had a double cutter. The two edges cut, and this old front was sharp. They put it in a long handle. I used to like my handle on buck boxes or snatch boxes just above my head, see, with the tool above the head. And you go up to that face with your peak coming this way, you'd lay that handle right outside of that tree, and that cutter would be situated just right. And you'd pull that way, and you'd step on the other side, and you'd turn it over and do the other way. And then as you're pulling, that was pulling, get on higher and higher. And that was the end of the operation there. And then to dip it, you take that bucket. You had a wooden paddle or a metal paddle. And you go there and you take that cup and you dip it out into your bucket, till you get your bucket full, see? And you situate your barrel stands where you could go out and dip back and be close to the barrel when you get your bucket full, so you wouldn't have to tote it so far, because it'd get heavy. You go out. And they know where the barrel stands. The wagon master, or wagon man, knew the barrel stands. He had a two-mule wagon with four regular old wagon wheels. He had two long pine poles that hanged off of the back, drug on the ground, skid pole. And in this barrel, they had a ring, a screw ring, and they had a head that was tip on there, and he'd take that head when he come to a full barrel, and he'd tighten that ring, lay that barrel on the ground, he'd get under it and roll it up in that wagon and set it up. Get him three barrels, he'd go to the still.
How many people do you think were working in that whole area of turpentining?
Oh, sometimes there's 200-300. It's according to how bigger tract of land they had. See, and they sometimes, I imagine, there were several hundred people working in one operation. Well, some of them were small. It's just like any other industry. See, the bigger the operation, see, the more people were working there.
Well, you started when you were 13. How long did you stay with turpentining?
Oh, remember, well, I was married in 32. I stayed in about 34, a little after 34. My son was born right there close to the Indian Pass trading post in 34. And sometime in that year, I believe it might have been 35, we moved out. And then we started doing other things other than that.
So after, what was your next job after you got, first you started off dipping and you were 13 or so, then what, did you start doing other things?
I went to chicken then.
Uh-huh.
After I quit dipping, when we moved to McNeil, see, I'm getting ahead of my story. When we left here in 25, we moved to Overstreet.
Uh-huh.
And we left there and Daddy went to work for the county. And I left the turpentine. I was so stiff then that I dipped and worked in the woods. That's the reason my legs isn't shaky off. I couldn't lay a stick broom down here and jump over it with both feet at one time. But Daddy been on this ferry, pulling these cars across over here to intersect. A lot of you know where the Intercoast Waterway is, where that floating bridge, where there was a barge there then. And Daddy been on that barge, on that ferry, putting them across there. $50 a month. $50 a month. And we come there, and he said, now here's your job. And I taken that, and I stayed there, and I didn't do anything except I'm reading novels. Sometimes I wouldn't have two cars in 24 hours to pull across that ferry. People come walking. I didn't pull a big barge. I had a skiff to pull that skiff across there. I stayed there, and I rested up, and I growed up, and I made a man. At 16, in 1928, we left there, and we moved on down to McNeil's, down in the past paper, in the turpentine business. Then we'll forget something. I'll tell you, this is kind of funny.
Okay.
We were out in the woods one day, and we're tired, and we're out at lunchtime. I believe there's a crew of us in the winter. In the wintertime, I better get this in there before I get too far. In the wintertime, we burned all these woods. The undergrowth of these woods causes snakes, and you couldn't go from tree to tree. And we'd go to those pine trees, and we had a big old hole with an eye in it. Not a gooseneck hole like you use in the garden, but a big old eyed hole with a big handle in it. We had a mark on it, 5 foot long. But we go to that tree that had the turpentine face on it. We'd rake all the trash and grass and cut it out, plumb clean, 5 foot around that tree in the wintertime. Then we go scrape off the face of those trees on the hill. Those yellow heart pine would not run much turpentine, and it would congeal on the face of the tree before it got down in the cup. And then in the wintertime, that's what we did in the winter, raise the cups, rake the boxes and scrape boxes without a winter job. But anyhow, this time was working as a little black boy out there in the woods with us, and Daddy pulled off his shoes to rest a while. And somehow or another, he had got a little drop of that turpentine on his foot, on his heel. And that little fella boy said, oh, Lord, says, I knows you was a tar heel, because you got tar on your heel. And we call that gum tar, see? And he said, I knows you a tar heel, because you got tar on your heel. So those little things happened all back to that. It stand out in my life. I could tell you them all day long. It happened in the 72 years. But when we stayed at Overstreet, we worked there and pulled that ferry. That was before the enlarged, the Intercoastal Waterway. And one time, the river got on a big rise like it's been now, and it flooded those woods. And the water got waist deep in our house. I had to take the beds and hang them up in the ceiling to keep them from getting wet.
And you had the big tall ceilings?
We was living in a boathouse.
Uh-huh.
It was just settled in the mud out there. And no, they had to move out. We had to move out. But anyway, Dad decided to go down to Turpentine. That's when we moved to Indian Pass and started working from down at the Indian Pass Trading Post. It was the Lagoon Company and Mr. Beelan, Jake Beelan, the president of the bank of the St. Joe Paper Company right now there in Port St. Joe. His daddy was running that turpentine place there, and we went down and went to work for them. And that's where I did most of my, uh, the, Memorial Day. So the thing that I remember the most was down there. That's where we did most of our church time. Me and her was married there. Our son was born there, and we used to fish a whole lot. And we was there in the Depression when times was hard. When me and her married, I was walking 3 miles night and morning to work and back, pulling 6,500 boxes for $3.56 a week. We had no expenses. We had no lights, no water, no everything. We lived in a turpentine shanty out there. We had a place to a kitchen and a bedroom and a fireplace and a stove. And you know, we didn't have any facilities at all. And we got along real good. There's a lot of fish and oysters. I went this past Thursday, when this crazy Northwest, we call it crazy Northwest, was blew all day long. I wanted to go oyster fishing. I have a little 14-foot gillnet skiff with a 2-horse Evan Rude motor, my oyster tongue, the 225 yards of gillnet, and my neighbor and I wanted to go gillnet. And he said, it's going to be blowing. I said, we can get up the Indian Pass Lagoon, we call it. We can get some oyster. We went down and launched our boat and run our little motor, had to find the deepest place. We went as far as we could go, and we couldn't even float that boat to the oyster bar. And we pulled with oars, and we couldn't go. I said, well, we're up here in the water. We're all right out here in this wind. Let's don't go back without some oysters. I said, there's a coon bar. Anybody don't know what a coon oyster bar is? You don't know what it is? Well, it's an oyster bar that's just cluttered up, an old cluster of oysters. Don't ever grow out. Don't ever get broke apart. Don't ever make anything, but just hindrance in the water. That's all it is. But sometimes around the edges of them, you can find oysters. It's good to be. I said, let's go back by that coon bar and get us a few oysters. He said, all right. We pulled back and pulled and pushed and met around, and we got us 2 bushels of oysters. Nice oysters. They're good oysters, small, but they were in good shape. And we came back, and the funny thing, when we got back to the landing, to the ramp, state ramp now, we saw a man there in a truck with the road department, Gulf County Road Department, talking on his loudspeaker, but he didn't say anything to us. We launched our boat and went on. And we come back and they had it blocked off. We couldn't even get back to get our boat to the car. They had run more concrete inside of this ramp and they put a barricade across that. I said, look here, we can't even get out, can we? He said, no. I said, yeah, I believe we can move that barricade. I believe I can put my truck between those holes they dug there. I said, in case we might stumble and get in there soft concrete, let's just go back around the commercial oyster place. Jimmy McNeil's place was back around the corner. So we went back around there, pulled our boat out, and come home. But
that was a surprise.
Now that
what about your meal while you were out there?
Yeah.
A meal? We put our cardboard on there. We had us a half a bucket full of oysters in the shell. We dumped them on this, and washed them off real good, got our hot stuff, our cold drink, and our crackers. We opened us all the oysters we wanted to eat, set them on that cardboard, and sit there and filled ourselves up. That was the meal that we had. A good raw oysters right there. Could you beat it?
No.
I mean, they're just as fresh.
Could we go now?
Just as fresh.
Would your boat hold us all?
Now then, and Lee talked to him about the blacksmith.
Buddy, let me ask you something about when you were in the woods. What did you all do about chiggers?
Sir?
What did you do about chiggers when you were walking around in the store?
Chiggers, they wasn't so bad then. We had to treat them. We had to, they're not so bad. We burned. You see, we got rid of them in the winter, mostly by burning the woods. We got rid of the ticks and chiggers. Of course, they were there. You'd have, we call them red bugs, you know, but same thing. We had trouble with them. They're not as bad in this country as they are further up the country, but burning the rotten trees and things that were laying on the ground every winter got rid of a lot of that stuff. And Mr. McNeil did have a bunch of cattle, and they had to dip them on account of the ticks, you know what I'm talking about, down there at that time.
So you didn't actually put anything on to keep...
No, we didn't really put anything. We'd go in, we'd have some kind of ointment. If we'd get one, we'd get him off and scratch him and make a little red place. And it never did bother us too much. Sometimes you'd get a tick on you, see, and different things. You did get some of it, but they were not as bad as you would hardly think so. And then...
Did St. Joe Paper own all the land back then where you were doing your turpentine?
No, sir. No, sir. St. Joe Paper. Where we were turpentine?
Who owned all the forest and swamp that you were working in when you were turpentine?
The Lagoon Company at that time owned down at McNeil's. There were four people, George Rhodes and Jimmis McNeil and Pick Higgins and Pick Hollander, owned that last place that I was. There's others. I really don't know who owned the land. At least the turpentine companies would lease the land, the timber, you know, lease the timber, the turpentine. But McNeil, the Lagoon Company, owned this last tract of land. These four people owned it, and old man Henry Bullard, and old man Jake Beelan, and old man Johnson, Kerry Johnson, leased that turpentine place. McNeil had the place of going in turpentine, and when they leased it from him, they leased that big tract of land to turpentine for the use of the turpentine timber, see.
Were people very particular about the boundaries, or did they...
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. They didn't get over the boundaries. They were some homestead places. You go down to Old 98, you know, from Port St. Joe, going around, like I'm talking about, around the Gulf. If you notice that hammock there, where they have this controversy about those palms going close to the road, that was a homestead. They never did turpentine that. If you notice, those big trees has been there ever since I can remember. And that's been quite a few years ago. Now, when they built this highway, 98, when I was on that ferry in 26 and 27, is when this highway was built here. Gulf Coast Scenic Highway, which is 98 now. No, sir, the turpentine men lease the timber, see. And when they get through turpentine, they pick up and move somewhere else, see. They work it out so high till there wasn't anything to it. And then a lot of times they go in back boxing, they call it. See, after they get way up here, if there's enough young timber grown up, see, they go behind and put another cup on there behind this back boxing, they call it. But then they get the other timber that was big enough to carry a phase besides their back boxing, see.
What happened to the pine trees after you couldn't get any more turpentine? Did they
cut them for lumber. They cut them for lumber and
putwood
and stuff.
Did it kill the trees?
No, ma'am. No, ma'am, it wouldn't kill them. It didn't hurt most of timber. The only thing would hurt a tree, a lot of times if you cut it too deep in the summertime, it would kill it. A lot of trees wouldn't stand it. A lot of trees would die from the faces, see. But as a general thing, it would grow up just like a wound in your body. This sap would grow over the face of that tree. And a lot of them, I got one in my yard right now that's got one of the old boxes. Back further than I can remember when they cut the first boxes in the tree, see. But that was before my time. I can't tell you anything about that. But the first one was boxed in the tree, and I've got one in my yard that has that face on it. And this new growth has almost covered the face of the cat face. Who was asking me about cat face? Cat face.
Yeah.
That cat face is almost covered with this new growth. Mm-hmm. All right, now go back to my blacksmith. We had done moved to Port St. Joe. Me and the wife had moved to Port St. Joe, living at Port St. Joe, and I was working with the State Road Department. And the way I found out about any work in the blacksmith shop, we were on one of the secondary roads in the city limits. And one of the boys that was working with us went to the post office. And he had a call to the paper mill to go to work in the paper mill. I had built a mill. There's a lot in there that we won't get to, but
yeah.
We're getting to starting my blacksmithing. But he had a call to go to the paper mill. Well, I turned around to Mr. Thurby. I said, well, I've got an application in there, too. I said, I might have a call. I said, let me go see about my mail. He said, all right. And I went to the post office, no mail, but I met Mr. Stetson Pritchard, the superintendent of the Apalachicola Northern Railroad Company's shop there in Port St. Joe. My brother-in-law had quit helping the blacksmith and left. And he looked at me and said, Buddy, he said, what are you doing? I told him. He said, I need a helper to help Mr. Waldo in the blacksmith shop. I said, well, I'll take it. That was in 40. So I taken that job, and I went back to Mr. Thurby. I said, I didn't have a call to go to the paper mill, but I got a call to go to the blacksmith shop. I went down there. Well, one fellow, he's dead and gone now, so is Mr. Waldo. He set me up bad to the man. Went and told the man, boy, he won't work. He's an old fisherman. He won't work. And I went in there, and this old German was pretty rough anyhow. And he didn't tell me that I had to build a fire in the forge every morning, see, to start heating up iron. So he just went ahead and built a fire in the forge. And we went ahead that day, and he didn't have much to say. The next morning he come in, he didn't tell me that was my job. Next morning he come in, stood around, said, what you waiting on? You use a big curse word. Said, build a fire in the forge. I said, well, I never built one in a forge. I said, but I'll try. But something clicked in my mind that he was going to hard time me, and I said to myself, I'll hit every piece of iron he puts on that anvil. I don't care how tired I am, I ain't going to give up, because I realized he was going to hard time me in the job, see, because of the other man talking to him. And so I built the fire, it wasn't too good. The next morning I kept on till I got where I could build a pretty good fire, and he was trying to burn me out, trying to do it. But anytime he put anything there, I'd hit it. And I'd watch him. He wouldn't say very much. He was a first-class blacksmith. Now, he was a first-class blacksmith. He could take a piece of half, an inch and a half rod, me and him, and we got together, to take that rod and weld it together. You couldn't see where it was put together. Forge weld, I mean. Mm-hmm. Not like you do with acetylene, right, or either electric weld. Anyhow, we made drawhead coupler yokes. Were those trains couple up, you know? Where they bam, you know, and hit hard, but it had a yoke on them. And those ends on those yokes, if you just bent that, it's 1 1/4 by 5 steel, 5 inches wide, 1 1/4 thick. And if you just bent them, they'd break off. And what he'd do, he'd put it out through the hammer and let me drive it back and make it thick enough to make that hook on there. And he had 2 or 3 links of that steel, and there's a, I know what he was doing. He said, well, we'll just make up all these drawhead coupler yokes. He's trying to burn me out. But I hit it every time he put it over there. I'd hit it with a 12-pound. I'd hit it if my tongue was hanging out. In 2 weeks' time, I broke that man's will, and he's one of the best friends I ever had. He made me the first pair of tongs that I ever had. I mean, lead molds, I didn't bring them with me, that I ever had. He made the first one. Me and him started hunting and fishing together. Uh-huh. And the war broke out in 1941, and I built a shipyard over here, and he came over here and got a job. He came back and got me, and I was the first experienced helper that went in Wainwright Shipyard. First man that went in there to strike on the anvil as a striker, as a helper that went in the Wainwright yard. I started helping him 2 weeks and made a blacksmith out of him. But you know that old man, after he's such a good a friend, he went to the office. And he said, what in the world are y'all doing? So that man ain't been working but a year, and I've been working 20 years. You're going to let him get as much money as I did? So they went back and started apprenticeship. I had to work so long to get so much, so long to get so much. But I could do the work. I could do the work. And they had a double arch steam hammer. Anybody else know what I'm talking about? It's a power hammer. It's an air hammer, steam hammer, big double arch. The hammer alone weighed 1,500 pounds. It would hit a 3,500 pound lake when it come down, like that. And they had a lady operating. She weighed 210 pounds. She sat on the stool right over that arch, you see. And the hammer worked in here, and she sat up with this arch. Uh-huh. She had a stroke lever in one hand, air lever in the other hand, see. And you'd fill up your stroke lever and get it enough air, and it'd start running. Uh-huh. The higher you get this, the harder it hits, see. The longer the stroke. But I got where I could work under that hammer. Me and, I believe it was 17 minutes that me and one of my helpers, he got where he could do it. We could make a 4-inch cable shackle. You know what a 4-inch, you know what a cable shackle is? Most of you know what shackle he's cabled with? 4 inches. The eyes, the head of 4 inches. And it was a huge thing. Out here, we'd take a piece of iron about that long, we'd pull it down on the ends, we'd draw the middle out, flatten the ball down where the pin went through it, and bend it in 17 minutes. And they come in there one day and they wanted a sheet metal roller, 10 foot long, I believe. And it had a spindle on each end of it. You know what a sheet metal roller is? Where they put those three rollers together, roll sheet metal. Well, they brought me a piece of steel. It was 12 inches in diameter, and I believe it was 24 inches long. And they wanted that sheet metal roller made out of that piece of 12-inch steel. And they throwed it in the fire, and they welded a handle on the crossbar. And it broke the crane down the first time. When they pulled it out of the fire the first time, the stiff leg had fixed to swing it from the furnace to the hammer. It broke it down. So they had to get rig us another one. And it took me 3 8-hour shifts. But I drawed that thing out to where they could take it in the machine shop and make a perfect roller, and you could see one place that the hammer touched. And I drawed it out round. You know, you can't draw, you can't take a, you can take a, say, a 1-inch piece of steel, and you want to make a point to a half an inch or a little bit of point. You just can't start rounding it in the fire. You can't do it. It'll bust all the pieces. It'll split all the pieces. What you have to do, you have to pack it. That's the way I had to do this. You flatten it on this side, that side, on this side, and then you knock the points off. Keep going that way until you get it down to what you want. See, making a punch or a chisel or anything, you can't just start rounding it up in the fire, get it hot, see. And this old man told me one thing, says, there's only two things that a blacksmith will ever go to hell for. I said, what is that? He says, that's beating on cold iron and not charging enough for his work. And that cold iron, you can't bend cold iron. You can't work cold iron. If it's cold, it won't work. But you can get it hot, and you can make it. You can make it any shape you want to. I can take a piece of steel, and with a good blacksmith forge and a good anvil and a good set of tongs, and I can make just anything I want to out of it. Bend it, shape it.
How did you draw out that large piece of steel?
Well, we're taking that big hammer, and I had this crossbar on it. Uh-huh. This lady was sitting here running that big hammer. And I flat, I square it down this way, back and forth, and it's getting longer and longer. See,
oh, I see.
I square it back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, until I got one end of it drawn down. See.
And it took 3 8-hour shifts.
3 8-hour shifts, and I get it drawn down this way, and I knock the edges off. See.
I see.
I knock the edges off, and one day the machine shop foreman come in there and said, "We want 12 foot of 2 3/4 hex steel to make nuts out of, to turn them out and make nuts, regular nuts." Well, now, squaring is easy. But when you go to hit, and you've got an extra side that you're not hitting against, see? At square, you can do it easy because you can beat this side a while and that side a while. But then you've got that other third side over there. You haven't got nothing there. You're going to push it out over that way. Well, I asked, I was working under a different foreman. The superintendent was, he was on day shift, and this was on the night shift. And I asked Mr. Edwards, I said, "Mr. Edwards, how are you going to make that steel?" He said, "We'll take 3 4-foot pieces." So we got some 7-inch car axle out of a box car, cut 7 inches in diameter, cut it up in pieces. He knew how much to cut. See, there's a way to figure that, how much big this piece is to make that piece so long set aside. So we put it under the hammer. He said, "I'll run the hammer for you." We had I believe a Miss Pate running the hammer at that time on the night shift. So I started working it out. And when I got that first end of it, I said, "Mr. Edwards, I got it just a little bit out of square." He said, "You want me to straighten it up for you?" I said, "Yeah." He straightened up that first end, stuck it in the fire, and I'm taking the other end, and it's perfect. I made the second piece just perfect as he did. And then the third, the last piece, I got it a little bit out of square. He straightened it up for me, and I went on there. See? And heavy, I was called a heavy forge blacksmith in the shipyard. Well, we worked at the shipyard, and the reason I'm not on a good retirement for somebody now, I didn't have sense enough to stay on a job long enough to go to retire. So I got mad with this old superintendent from Philadelphia. He's hard on me. He gave me a fit. He is one of them kind of Yankees. You know what I'm talking about. Anyhow, I won't say it too loud. But anyway, he was one of them, and we didn't get along. So I left. I left there, went back to commercial fishing. Where I'm commercial fishing for their St. Joe Paper Company, and then we wanted to move over here. So I went back to State Road Department. I was working back at the ferry, back at Overstreet. Back to the Overstreet. It was floating bridge, and I was standing there tending that floating bridge. We wanted to move over here. I moved over here, and I didn't have a job, a very good job, and so I moved over here, and I was working a little sawmill out there, cutting those tin. Those men out there laughed at me some, put me on the ramp, cutting those nails and tins out of those turpentine trees, and I told them, I said, "I put part of them tins in there," and they just had a big laugh. Said, "Well, that's good for you to have to cut them out of those logs, because sawing it into lumber It would ruin his saw if he hit those nails, and I had to take an axe and cut them out. And it was so hot until I had been sitting on that ferry for over 2 years, and I weighed 245 pounds, and I was just soft. I couldn't take it. I mean, I got to where I couldn't see my hand before my face. And I went and told the foreman, I said, I'm about to pass out. I'm about to get too hot. He said, well, get over there in the shade and sit down a while. And worked there for about 3 weeks. We had moved over here, bought us a home over here, a good high-priced home, no job, no nothing over here, and moved over here. Moved on faith altogether. Moved over here on faith altogether. And so a friend of mine said, well, down at the shop, said, there's a man's fixing to quit down now. So if he quits, I say, you let me know. I won't go down there. See, I done got out of my blacksmith, and I had never had a shop to run by myself. So this man left, quit, left. And I went in and talked to Mr. Waddell. Mr. Foy Waddell lives here in town now. He's got a business over here on the bow. A lot of people knows about the Bay Propeller Marine Works over here. And Mr. Waddell was running the shop. I went in and talked to him. He said, well, he said, I'll talk to you about it. I got to talk to another man. And I happened to think Mr. Waldo used to work for him, the man that trained me. And I said something about Mr. Waldo. He said, did you work under him? I said, he's the one that trained me. He said, well, you ought to be a good one then, because he was the only first-class blacksmith I've seen since Jake Goddard left here. Jake Goddard used to work down there as a German, and he was first class. But Mr. Waldo didn't get along good in the shipyard because he finished his work under the anvil. He wanted to finish his work, and the shipyard didn't want that. They want it roughed out. They had a machine shop over there, a crew of men, to finish it, see? Just rough it out and throw it down. Rough it out and throw it down. That's what they wanted. But Mr. Waldo was used to finishing it, taking whatever time is necessary, because he worked as a maintenance man in the Appalachian Northern Railroad Company. So Mr. Waddell said, well, you come down here tomorrow, and I'll let you know where to go to work or not. I said, then if I do that, I'll miss my day's work. Out here, working for $1 an hour. Out here at the little sawmill between Fort Panama and William Hitchcock, see? But I was doing anything to get the move over here. We wanted to move to Panama, and I had already moved, see? And he said, well, said, I tell you what, said, just call me. I called him, he said, come on to work. Put me to work, and I worked there until the place began to fold up. And that just about ended my career blacksmithing then, and I fixed up in a little shop at home and so forth. So of course I was in the city limits, and pretty soon the neighbors got hollering about the smoke, and I had to discontinue my blacksmithing at home. See, I can't use that at home anymore on account of too many neighbors got clotheslines. I don't blame them. I'm not fussing about that, but I can't do that because it's a good hobby with me. I love to bend iron. I love to heat iron. You can get iron to a certain heat. You can get it hot enough with a good forge. If you know what you're doing, you can get two pieces hot enough, and you can put them together, and they'll weld into one another, and you can't tell where they're welding. Now, Mr. Waldo, the side rods that drives these old steam locomotives, they broke one in Port St. Joe at that railroad company, and he wasn't working there at that time. And Mr. Pridgen went and asked him. He said, Earl, will you come down here and weld that side rod for me? He said, yep. He said, I won't weld that one. Somebody else had tried to weld it. See, they didn't have the electric welding up to what it is now. He said, if you'll get me another head, that was that big head that went on the wheel, see, and a stem, said, I'll weld it, but I won't weld this one, but I need 5 good helpers. He said, all right. And he went down there and welded that big, huge piece of steel together in the forge. And the inspector came and scraped the paint off it, tried to find a flaw in it so he could turn it down, and couldn't find one. And I suppose it's still on one of those old locomotives right on. But then, after the shop began to close out, I had my little shop at home. I just, after they, so much squawk, I said, all right. I started melting leads, making leads, see. And I started to make them with a gas pot. I saw this coming 15, 20 years before it come. Went and bought me one of those plumber's pots with a top screw on the top, and the fire goes right out of the tank, right up in the office, right in your blower, and then I heat my lead that way to make my leads. I don't blacksmith anymore on account of the squawk. And then now go back to my cast netting days. Well, that's another line. Have we got time?
Yeah, we sure do. I think everyone wants to hear about your cast netting and get you to show us what.
All right, when we moved to Indian Pass, we moved in December 1928. My uncle, Daddy's brother, already lived at Indian Pass, and they had a little old cast. Now, we were nothing like that. Oh, we had a little about this long, 5 or 6 foot long. And they were just plenty of mullet in those marshes in the head of that Indian lagoon where I was talking about. And I've been eating fish and oysters out of this same place that I was at last Thursday for ever since 1928. There's oyster bars, you get mud about half leg deep or leg deep. You can wait out on those bars, and we have sat down, me and my daddy have sat down on those bars, take a 5 gallon bucket and sit down and open a half a gallon or a gallon apiece right on that bar, never get up. Biggest, finest, prettiest oysters you ever saw. Go back home, Mama would cook them. There's numerous ways that you can cook oysters, see. She'd cook them every kind of a way. She'd take and make her a meal, gruel and fry it, you know, and then she'd fry those oysters. After she'd get it all cooked, she'd fry those oysters in it. She'd make her a batter, and she'd drop the oyster in it, pick it up and fry that. She'd stew them, she'd fry them, we'd eat them raw. We'd just sit down, we lived like a king. That's when we was making $2 a week, $3 and $4 a week apiece. And then we'd go down there with our cast nets, and it was mullet just thick as you ever saw. I saw my daddy take one of those little nets and walk up on a little oyster bar point out there. The mullet was feeding around those burrs, see, just rooting. You know, they're a sucker. They root in the ground and get what they eat out through their gills. They don't catch no live stuff like a bass or anything. They root in the dirt, and they get what to get out of that, or the skim on top of the water and let the water go through their gills. That's the way they live. Those mullet was rooting around there. I didn't have a net, I don't believe. Daddy walked up there and he threw that net on that oyster bar, and it just come alive. It exploded. And he run out, and those oyster bars was turning his lead line, roll over, you know, ragging it to throw his lead line off in the bottom. He just went out and gathered a net, oyster burrs and mullet, and went out on the hill, and he had 25 big old feeding mullet, pound and a half and 2 pound mullet at one throw with that cast net. And you go down there, and to get a little old creek wouldn't be that long, that wide, just big enough for him to go in. And the grass would be growing thick a lot of places. He'd go through that grass and go up in those little places. I walked around in there, it wouldn't be a place big enough to throw your net harder, and throw in there and catch 5 and 6 big mullet. I mean, 1.5 to 2 pound mullet. And so what we did back when the times were so hard, the colored people working in the Turpentine State, well, nobody had no money, you know. Nobody had no money. We traded in the commissary. Mr. McNeil's mother run the commissary. When Mr. Beelan leased the Turpentine place, rented it from Mr. McNeil, or leased it, Ms. McNeil told him, said, "Mr. Beelan, if you'll let me run the commissary, I'll give you 10% of what I make." Well, she's pretty. She, her name served her just right. Just, and I won't say no more about that. But she, the price on the groceries. She didn't pay nothing out of her pocket. We paid that 10%. But anyway, he run the Turpentine business. She run the store, see. And mostly, when you go in at the end of the week, they give you, if you wanted groceries this week, paid off every 4 weeks. You go in there, and he'd give you a purchase, just same as a purchase order. If you go down here, if you're working a company, you go into the store, he'd give you a purchase order or something. But he'd give you a work order. You go down, if you didn't trade it all out, you have a little old ticket. I know some of you saw where the numbers around the edge, and he had a, if you didn't trade it all, you'd do that. But what we would do, we'd go down there and we'd catch those fish, all we could tote in a sack back to the house. We didn't know nothing about nets, lead lines and cork lines and all, but we come over here to this Menhaden plant. Where St. Joe paper, I'm pointing over here because like I was in St. Joe, but you know where the paper mill is right now. Where the paper mill in Port St. Joe is, but it was a pogey plant. We call it a pogey plant. It was a fertilized fish plant where they ground up those Menhaden, they fertilize and oil, see. We came over there and they had those webs, the huge seines, and we got us a piece of that web and we cut it off as deep as we wanted. Didn't have no leads and lines and the corks and nothing. So we went in those mud ditches and we'd go walk across there and push it down in the mud. We'd go out in the woods and cut those palms, those palmettos, we call them, fan sticks. We stick them up along there and hang it up on it. The tide would go down, the mud would come down and settle against our net. And we'd go down there sometime and get all we could throw back to the house. One day we got 42 flounders that's come up there in the summertime, and they died in that water, dying. We had to go get them. They turn their head and tail up. We go pick them up, put them out of sack, and we got them out. We'd take those fish back up in the quarters. We'd go by that cooker shed where that man made those barrels, put that rosin in, you know. They had regular 55-gallon barrels to put the spirits of turpentine in, but then they had made straight barrels to put the rosin in. That's something we done. We missed a part of that, yeah, in the turpentine. But anyway, we'd go out there and we'd get that wire that this stave was wired up with. We'd go to the house, we'd string those mullet on that string. Or I'd take me a string, and we'd put 5 and 6 big old mullet on the string for a quarter. We'd go down through the quarters. I said, John, you want to mess them up? I said, yes, I take quarters with Mr. Bay. I put his name down. Uh-huh. We'd go on down through that way until we get all the way, all the fish sold out. Well, maybe by the end of the week, I'd done sold out 2 or 3 catches. See, we'd work about 4 days a week, and the rest of the time we're fishing. Well, come Saturday, when I take that list, Ma said, here's what I got now. And she'd say, well, I want him to get this, and him to get that, and him to get the other, what he got right on down. I'd go down to the store, because evidently I didn't get nothing. They wouldn't buy it if you weren't there. So when they came in to buy the groceries, I'd say, well, John, you get me iced potatoes for your 50 cents. You get me white meat for your 50 cents. You just that and the other. And I've had a big old tote sack slam full of packages of groceries, more than I could tote home at the end of the day. So we made our groceries with our mullet, and then we had our $2 or $3 a week, clear.
Well, when did you learn to make the casting?
Well, that's when we started making the cast net. I'm about to get away from that. My uncle already was there, and he had a cast net. Mm-hmm. And we started then, and we started knitting our own cast net right then, just like we've got right here.
What were they made out of?
Cotton. So here is one, like we made then, made out of cotton. We'd hang it up like that, and we'd make that net. And we'd have to put our increasers in, see, to make it get bigger. That's what I'm doing there, is an increaser. You see, you get the regular mesh, and you keep knitting around the regular mesh till every third row you put in an increaser row. This is the old style. This is nylon, but we used what you call sea island cotton. Couldn't get nylon. Nylon was not even made at that time, see.
What happened with the Sea Island cotton? Did it just...
Well, nylon taking the place up. Somebody say something to me.
Turn your hand up. He's trying to take 15. Can't see what you're doing with your needle.
Where did you get the needle that you're working with?
I made it myself.
And did you have to do that? You have to make the needles when you first were learning?
Yes, ma'am.
You couldn't buy them?
Yes, ma'am. We had to make the shovel. Yes, ma'am.
What would you make it out of?
Hickory or either pecan wood. These are made out of pecan wood.
Uh-huh.
I went up to my wife's people one time in River Junction, was on the way back home, and Joyce, we had a little trouble with our hanging.
It's our humming.
That's all right. I got
Does
it.
Does that work?
And I went up to visit her people at River Junction, and on the way back, I come where they're building I-10, and when I came back, and they were building I-10, and they were cutting down a pecan orchard. Well, this is typical right here now, I'm going to tank. We do that a lot, and
the
more you do it, the worse it gets. And so I came by, and they were cutting I-10, and they cut down a man's tunnel. And so I stopped there and I told him, I said, I want to get some of that pecan wood. And he said, okay. He went out there and cut me down some blocks of pecan. See, this is pecan wood here, see. It's good, tough wood. And it won't break, and that's why I make my shuttles out of it. Now, let me show you something. Look this real good. This is the increaser, see?
Can we come up and look?
Yeah, come on. Anybody wants to see the increase this net to make it get bigger, you have to put in an extra mesh. see, you have to put an extra mash in. You have to go up in that fork to put that extra mash in, see. That's extra to the other one. That puts you another loop in there, see. See. And you always see this is a gauge board now. The gauge you mash, make your gas, that mashes the same. And we use this, which is a square knot when it's thrown down. And if you don't watch it, let's turn this over one more time. Get your hand like that. Now, if you don't make it come catch that loop, you see this loop on top of that board. If you don't hold it tight and make it come up above that knot, it makes a slip knot. See? If you make it come up like that. Now the next one will be an increase. And if you knit two rounds, if you go two rounds around it, you can put your increase of one right under the other one. But if you don't, it won't do that, see? It takes you about 3 weeks. It'll take about 3 weeks. Now this is the old style. I got something else I'll show you. This is the way we used to make it. You knit them that way, you knit it as long as you wanted it. Usually about 300 mashes around the bottom. But now I've got a better way, a better way now than see this is the increaser, see, when you get your picture over here on the other side. You go up through this right here, and that puts an extra loop around your board, see. That makes your net get bigger. And you have to go around it three times, around this way, three times before you can put your increaser in. Now that's the old style making them, which is going out of date. We don't use that anymore. Now let me show you something else. Let me get on this side where y'all can see me over there. Now this net right here, this is a 10-foot net. And it's cut with eight boards where I'm putting those widenings in over there with 11. Take this and walk back with it, son. This is 10 foot long. And you cut this on a 2-to-1 taper, see? And it gets bigger and bigger. See, it's only four mashes down at the other end. And it's over 6 foot wide. At the top, we put eight gores of this together, see?
And it comes like this?
Yeah, I cut it like this.
Oh, you cut
That's
it like
That's what
this.
I'm going to show you.
And it comes in a big, long roll.
It comes in just a sheet of, just like a gill net or a seine, just like you'd order a bolt of cloth off and come up there. And now, and here's a piece I'll show you how I cut it. I take my cutter, see? Here's what I use to cut it with. A pair of ladies' thread clippers.
Yeah.
And they always on your finger, they always loaded.
Oh, yeah.
You don't cut your finger like you do with a knife. Those are shuttles that I made, ladies.
Yeah,
I made both of those. Yeah. Both of those are made just alike.
They're a miracle, just themselves.
All right, see, I take these mashes. 1, 2, 3, 4. All nets starts with 4 at the top. No matter what length, the length determines the size. All right, I cut a flap. And a flat, see? And then I cut a point.
Yeah.
And that gets bigger as you go down, see? That's your taper. And then you cut off another two-legged one. And then you come out here and you cut it off. And this gets bigger and bigger as you go down, see? Of course, this is just a miniature. I'm just showing the way that I do it. Then I turn the big ends together. Let's get two of these right here. We need to. See, I get... Let's find another square in it.
How do they make this stuff?
The nylon net company. This is Japan. They haven't ever learned to make this in the United States. Hold that for me. They never learned to make this in the United States. All right, now this is two that I put together. Now, I'll show you something right here. In putting this together, you have to start, see, with a... You can't start on this two-legged point. You can't start there.
Now then, start on a flat.
Let's see that you got over there now. All right, this has got your point on it. This is, hold that right there. This has got your point on it, see, to start with, the two-legged. When you come over here, you find one. If you don't, you make one.
Yeah.
All right, now let's see. You have to have, I don't have two hands. Sometimes I need four.
I think I need about eight.